Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Lacey M. Johnson. She teaches creative writing at Rice University in Houston, and her new collection of essays, The Reckonings, is available now from the good folks at Scribner. Her 2014 memoir was called The Other Side, recounted her kidnapping and rape by an ex-boyfriend, and this book of essays, although it stands alone, serves in a way as a follow-up to The Other Side. Lacey, after people read the most intimate details of your rape and kidnapping, what was it that people would ask you that gave rise to this compilation of essays?
People kept asking me what I wanted to have happen to the man who committed this crime against me. And though that was the question, they always also assumed that I would want him dead. And that I just found so surprising and so off-putting, and especially because it was so consistent across, various readers and different events that I would get the same question over and over. And I found that surprising because I don't want him dead. I don't even necessarily want him to suffer, which isn't to say I don't want him to face consequences. But I actually want something quite different.
Well, you were a direct victim of violence. A good friend of mine who used to produce this program was murdered a year and a half ago, so I was an indirect victim of that type of violence. And I found just in my own life that closure and the idea of reckoning takes a lot of forms. The need for revenge and the need for to know why, the need for inner peace and everything in between. Is this whole idea of reckoning something akin to the 12 stages of grief?
I think it might be. And first of all, I'm so sorry to hear about that loss. That sounds like a terrible violence and a terrible loss.
Thank you.
To have to suffer.
Thank you.
But I don't know that I think about it in terms of stages so much as I think when something happens like a terrible violence such as that or such as what happened to me, it one of the things that it seeks to do, I think, a violence like that is to deny who we are as people. And one of the things that I think a reckoning should do is to reaffirm our experience as people. I write in this book how, though, you know, the man who kidnapped and raped me obviously did really terrible things to my body, we had been in a relationship for 2.5 years that was abusive. And the worst thing that he did to me wasn't even necessarily the violence he committed against me and my body. It was the violence he did against the story I told myself about the person I could be. And that kind of violence, it sort of denies who you are as a person. And the justice that I want is a reckoning, which to me means that I have who I am and who I can be reaffirmed again. That not only does he have to tell me what he did to me in public and affirm my experience, but as I write in the book, I wish that then he had to spend his life in service to other people's joy. And I think that is just a really different idea, I think people sometimes struggle with letting go of the idea of revenge.
We throw this term justice around in society all the time, and it's so elusive. And, you know, we don't let the friends of a murder victim or of a rape victim serve on a jury of the accused or a jury of the person accused with the crime because their idea of justice may not be what's best for the citizenry as a whole. But is there any one right idea of justice, or is it a subjective thing?
That's a hard question. I think right now the definition of justice that we have, that we've received down from, you know, 5 millennia ago in the Code of Hammurabi is the, you know, the eye for an eye, which is, it goes, if you do something bad happens to you, and therefore justice. The problem that I see with this definition is if we define an injustice as anything that causes suffering or gets between a person and their joy, and justice as being that same thing as anything that causes a suffering, we're sort of caught in a loop where we're constantly perpetuating injustices on one another over and over and over. And my book seeks to find another way. I think in our justice system, which I don't write about a lot, you know, there are a lot of writers who have written very excellent books recently about the justice system, and I would point your listeners to those, such as you know, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow or Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy. I think, you know, the justice system seeks to punish and it seeks to enforce the laws and focuses all its attention on the people who do the harm rather than the people who suffer the harm, who have experienced the injustice, and that almost nothing is done to care for them or to sort of make the condition of joy a possibility again for that person, or to make sure that they are healing and moving on. All of the emphasis is on the person who's done the terrible thing. And I don't think that is necessarily what justice is so much as it is just a form of law enforcement.
One of the things I really liked about your book is whenever I see a book of essays, I think, oh, they're all going to be kind of flowery and mostly ranty type things. Yours all told stories and had a point that backed up those stories, and you wanted to keep reading the essay to find out what happened in the story and how it related to the theme of that particular essay. But, for instance, you have an essay in there called Speak Truth to Power. You use Greek mythology to explain how men try to silence women, and there's no question that it's been going on throughout all of history. But how does it work in the present day, perhaps with the language we use in situations that arise?
So I think that in the case of that particular essay, there are many ways that that women are silenced, especially when they try to talk about sexual assault, and I think some of us have seen that in the news in the last several weeks. But one thing that I've noticed in particular is even the way that we talk about sexual assault, we talk about the number of women who are raped, the number of college students who have been raped. We talk about the people who have been abused, and that construction of the sentence totally takes the people who are doing the harm out of it. Instead, we should talk about the number of people who rape or the number of people who abuse. And though we have, at best, a kind of estimation of the number of women who are raped, again, with that same problematic construction, I think we have very little idea and no real sense of the number or the percentage of men, for instance, who commit these crimes. And that even if we shift our language towards focusing on the people who are doing the harm, it will become apparent that it's not just a thing that happens to women, it is a thing that men are doing to women.
I talked to David Sedaris a few years back, and he told me when he writes his memoir essays for The New Yorker, even though they're humorous, The New Yorker will call every relative that he mentioned in that story and fact-check it and want to dig into the details to make sure there's an element of truth. As a writer who's written a memoir, did you have that experience when you wrote The Other Side that the publisher was calling and checking every detail of your story, or did they take you at your word?
I think for the most part with The Other Side, people took me at my word. I mean, I do have a lot of documentation to back up, what I went through, because in that I'm writing about being the victim of a violent crime. And so I have police reports and, you know, notes from my therapists and my own emails and documentation. And I think that those serve as important forms of evidence. But in the case of memoirs, as opposed to essays, you know, we think of memoirs being a story that you tell about an experience, but really memoir is about memory. And that book in particular is about my memory of this, you know, really the worst thing that ever happened to me, and the way that that moment in my life sort of spread throughout, you know, my understanding of who I was, all the way into, you know, the present, where I was trying to be a good parent to my children and just not being able to escape the feeling that this is something that was still happening to me. And so, you know, there isn't necessarily any form of evidence or any form of fact-checking that I can do on what I remember. It's only my memories that I have to draw from in terms of what I remember. But in that book in particular, I did find some interesting ways in which my memories of certain events did not line up to the documents. And it wasn't that necessarily about the crime itself, but as an example, I write, or in my memory, when I went to the police station, I remember immediately speaking to a male detective. But when I read the police reports, I found out that I actually spoke to a female officer initially. And when I try very hard, I can remember that. But a lot of things kind of start to fall apart if I focus on that memory instead of the one that I have told myself, you know, for the past 18 years. And I think that book in particular was just a sort of fascinating study in how memory works, and in particular how traumatic memory works.
All right, we just scratched the surface of this collection of essays. It's called The Reckonings by Lacey M. Johnson. The book is available now from Scribner, wherever your fine books are sold, and you can get it online as well at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Lacey, just a fantastically interesting book. I learned so much from reading it, and thanks for sharing your story and joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Let the whole world